Well, the first thing I think he would do would be to stand up and tell the truth. I mean, he had a great expression that was just tell the truth and watch them scatter.
So the further away the problem is, the easier it is to postpone action on it. And that's essentially what we're doing.
Be real. Because people in New Hampshire are really cool.
I'd say get in the game. This is a problem facing your generation. You have to have a voice in the decision.
Welcome to Facing the Future, brought to you by the Concord Coalition on WKXL, New Hampshire's talk radio station. Tune in each week as we dive into topics related to fiscal policy, like healthcare, taxes, national security, the national debt, and more. You'll hear discussions with experts, elected officials, and industry leaders on how the nation's fiscal and economic challenges impact current and future generations, and we'll explore some of the solutions. I'm your host and Director of Strategic Initiatives for the Concord Coalition, Chase Hageman. Today, Concord's Executive Director Bob Bixby, Policy Director Tori Gorman, National Field Director Phil Smith, Dr. Mark Zandi, Chief Economist from Moody's Analytics, and Kwanzaa Hall, Congressman from Georgia's 5th District, will join the show to discuss economic trends and fiscal and monetary policy, what should be considered for the next COVID-19 relief package, as well as what it's like to serve in Congress and finish out the term of legend and civil rights hero, the late Congressman John Lewis. But before we dive into today's discussion, let's kick off the program with our first segment, Facing the News, where we will take a few minutes to see what is going on in the world of fiscal policy this week. The budget tracker for CQ Roll Call is reporting that after making a big splash last week, a bipartisan $908 billion plan for coronavirus relief was seemingly hung up earlier this week over liability protections for businesses. The $908 billion plan is being eyed as the baseline for a new aid package lawmakers plan to attach to an omnibus fiscal year 2021 spending bill. A one-week stopgap measure to buy more time to write the massive package is on tap for this week. President-elect Joe Biden endorsed the framework with little equivocation. Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer said it could use, quote, improvements, including more money for state and local governments. Up next, Dr. Mark Zandi, Chief Economist from Moody's Analytics, Bob Bixby, Concord's Executive Director, and Tori Gorman, Concord's Policy Director, will be joining me to discuss economic trends in fiscal and monetary policy, as well as what should be considered for the next COVID-19 relief package. We'll be back after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman, and I'm joined in the show by Dr. Mark Zandi, Tori Gorman, and Bob Bixby. Bob is the Concord Coalition's Executive Director. Tori is Concord's Policy Director. Both are regular contributors on the show. Mark is Chief Economist of Moody's Analytics, where he directs economic research. He's on the board of directors of MGIC, the nation's largest private mortgage insurance company, and is the lead director of Reinvestment Fund, one of the nation's largest community development financial institutions, which makes investments in underserved communities. Mark is a co-founder of Economy.com, which Moody's purchased in 2005. He frequently testifies before Congress and conducts regular briefings on the economy for corporate boards, trade associations, and policymakers at all levels. Mark is often quoted in national and global publications and interviewed by major news media outlets. He's also the author of Paying the Price, Ending the Great Recession and Beginning a New American Century. His other book, Financial Shock, a 360-degree look at the subprime mortgage implosion and how to avoid the next financial crisis, is described by the New York Times as the clearest guide to the financial crisis. Mark also received his PhD at the University of Pennsylvania. Welcome to Facing the Future, Mark, Bob, and Tori.
Thanks.
Thanks, Jace. It's good to be on with you and Tori and Bob. It's good to be with you guys. Thank you.
Well, pleasure to have you all here. And we're going to jump right into the conversation talking about your economic update that you just put out. You titled this the update as This Week in the COVID Crisis. So what is going on this week in the COVID crisis?
Well, I have to say this week, top of mind is the fragile recovery. The economy is struggling. Got a data point last Friday for the employment for the month of November, and it showed a gain, but of only 250,000 jobs, which, you know, in a normal time, that would be okay, pretty good. But, you know, given that we're still down 10 million jobs from the pre-pandemic level, and given that all the trend lines here, given the raging pandemic and the fading of any fiscal support, suggest some job losses dead ahead and perhaps increases in unemployment, which is already still very high, is pretty disconcerting. So on the virus, on the pandemic, you know, I do think the next couple, 3 months will be difficult. I'm just channeling, you know, the healthcare professionals here. And it's pretty obvious it's going to be a bit of a mess. We have not contained the virus. We botched the healthcare response to the virus. I do think everything suggests that we will get a vaccine, vaccines that are effective, distributed, adopted. You know, in my baseline worldview, I expect at least 25 million Americans to be inoculated by, say, a couple months from now, and probably 125 million by the end of the year. And then you consider that we'll probably have just as many people that have been infected by the virus and have some form of immunity, so that by this time next year, I think we're pretty close to what you might consider herd immunity. And I think that's absolutely necessary for the economy to get off the ground in a strong, consistent way. And so that's why I'm much more optimistic about, you know, what the world looks like. If we reconvene and have this conversation a year from now, I think we'll feel a lot better about how things are going, both with regard to the pandemic, but also with regard to the economy. So that's sort of my baseline. There's obviously a lot of risk, positive, negative risk around those assumptions, but that's how I think about the virus. On fiscal policy, I do believe we need another fiscal rescue relief package to navigate from here to the end of the pandemic, because all support is now fading fast. And by the end of the year going into next, what remaining support remains will have expired, you know. And I really worry a lot about the expiration of unemployment insurance. Unemployment is 6.7%. And there's a lot of folks that have stepped out of the workforce that if they were in, the unemployment rate would probably be closer to 8 or 9, which is very, very high by any, you know, historical standard. And I also worry about rental assistance. There's we have a moratorium on rental eviction that expires at the end of the year, unless it's extended, you know, by the CDC, by President Trump. A lot of low-income renters who've been hammered by the pandemic will lose their homes in the dead of winter in the middle of a raging pandemic. And I can go on, small businesses and airlines, and we need more money for testing and PPE and tracing and schools. And so I do think we need another fiscal package. If we don't get it, if we don't get any support, I think we're going back into what you might consider a recession. This period will go down in history as a double dip recession, a W-shaped economic outlook. So we need that help. You know, there's obviously things we need to talk about in terms of the implications fiscally long run, but you know, at this point, I think we need to get this economy to the other side of the pandemic before we worry about those things.
You sort of mentioned or laid out a timeline of the vaccine and inoculations and where we could be on the health side of things. In terms of the script and timeline of Congress acting and seeing effective policy here to bring relief and stimulate the economy to get it growing again, how long do you think it could take if we took all the right steps? And that's probably a utopian world there, but if we took all the right steps, how long could it take to get back to where we were before the pandemic?
Well, I think it's going to be a process. It's going to be a bit of a slog. I mean, we're down 10 million jobs. We lost 22 million in March and April. We've gotten 12 million back. We're down 10 million. We're only getting, you know, last month in November, we got 250K back. You can kind of do the arithmetic. If that's where we stay, it's going to be a long, long time. I don't think that, you know, it's going to be, the pace of recovery is going to be that slow. It'll be faster, but you do the arithmetic, it's probably going to take several years. I'd say 3 years, it would be kind of my base case, before we get all those jobs back and we feel like we're back to full employment. So, you know, late 2023. One big assumption, there's lots of assumptions, obviously, but one big assumption is that we will not get any additional legislation of consequence on the economic policy side after this package that we're debating now, that I'm assuming the Republicans win the Senate. Senator McConnell remains the leader, of the Senate. And if that's the case, I think it'll be difficult in odds less than even that we get another major fiscal package.
So Mark, I got a quick question for you. We're talking a little bit about the next relief package. It seems to me that Republicans in the House and the Senate are looking a lot towards things like third quarter GDP data and the drop in the unemployment rate as sort of justification for going much smaller on a relief package than what I think a lot of people would expect or think that we need. I look at that data, and that data is backwards looking. It's a look in the rearview mirror. What happened, a quarter ago in terms of economic activity? What happened last month with jobs? In your mind, is there data that policymakers would be better served at looking at, in that it's more forward looking in terms of driving public policy? I mean, Bob wrote a column the other day where he talked about our health indicators are our economic indicators, and that looking at those should perhaps drive policy. But as an economist, and knowing what it takes to rev up an economy, I was wondering if there are specific data points that are more forward-looking than GDP and unemployment rate to sort of help drive policy.
Bob has a good point. I mean, in the current pandemic, I think what's going on with the virus goes a long way to saying what's going to happen to the economy. It's not hard to connect the dots between the infections, particularly hospitalizations, obviously, because if hospitals get overwhelmed, then local officials have no choice but to pull back their businesses, restaurants, bars, gyms, restricting the number of people who can get together in public spaces. And people also self-quarantine, they're nervous. They you can see in the mobility data, this recent surge in infections and hospitalizations has caused people to kind of pull back on moving around, and that goes directly to economic activity. Those links are not quite as strong as they were, back in the summer when we had this kind of that second wave, and certainly not compared to when we shut down everything back in March and April, but those relationships still hold. And so that's a pretty good indicator. If you've got infections over 200K per day confirmed and over 100K in hospitalizations and news stories of hospitals that are having trouble, with their ICU units, that gives you a pretty good sense the economy is going to struggle. And that's what you see in the data. The most, I think the best data to be looking at though, in the current context, real time, is probably the employment data. It's a little bit lagged, no doubt, but it is. The survey for December is being done next week, and we're going to get that data, in the first week of January, right after New Year's. That gives you a pretty good sense of, what's going on. I mean, there's obviously every data point, everything we look at has problems, particularly in the fog of a pandemic. But I think that's a pretty good data to look at. I personally look at a lot of other data, third party data, non-government data. So for example, we have a relationship with a payroll processor ADP. And so I get a sense that's 23 million employees, and that's updated every day, and I can see what's going on there. And the Fed looks at that data too, so they're looking at, it's not public data, but it's it's released once a month. But there's other data that is released that's very valuable that I look at. From Homebase, that's data on employment for smaller businesses. I look at data from this company called Cortera. Cortera tracks business to business spending real time, and it's very cool data, interesting data, and you can look at it by industry, by company size, by zip code if you want to. And B2B spending in lots of industries a very clear indication of what's going on B2C, business to consumer. And so, because like Walmart buys from its vendor, I see that data, and then it sells to consumers, so it's a very good kind of leading indicator. And so there's all kinds of data like that become more, certainly I didn't have that in the financial crisis a little over a decade ago, but now we do. And I find it quite valuable in trying to assess what's going on right now. But, bottom line for policymakers, I don't think I'd be looking at GDP. That's quarterly, it's lagged. I would look at the, straight up, how many jobs are being created month to month, and what's happening with the unemployment rate and the underemployment rate, folks that have been pushed out of the workforce.
Sort of picking up on that from a different, little bit different perspective, we are getting some signs of activity on the Hill that they might be reaching a bipartisan agreement of some sort. Those are always easier to talk about than to actually do. So there are still some snags over portions that have been snagging them all summer. But given the scenario that you've outlined and the healthcare indicators that are looking as bleaker than the economic indicators, what do you think are the best bang for the buck policies that they could put in there?
Well, I mentioned a couple. I mean, I think the most important thing at this point in time, well, first of all, money for testing. I mean, that seems like a no-brainer. We should be testing very, very aggressively and at no cost. I think that's one of the reasons why Asia has been so good at managing the crisis. Not only did they lock down significantly, but more importantly, they have been testing and tracing very aggressively ever since. So I have operations throughout Asia. I was just literally just this morning talking to a woman who works for me who went back to Shanghai about 3 weeks ago. And she told me that in the 3 weeks, and this is, you know, leaving here, going there, doing all the things she needs to do to be there, quarantining. She's had 13 COVID tests already, 13. I mean, that gives you a clear sense of they're not going to let that virus come back in, right? So, I think that's really very important. We're not talking a lot of money here. We're not talking hundreds of billions. We're talking billions, you know, that kind of thing. And then I think we need to be really focused on the human economic costs. You know, I mentioned the rental assistance for people who have a lot of back rent due because of the eviction moratoria. And the unemployment insurance. You know, those are unemployed folks that have exhausted all their benefits. They're getting a check because of the special pandemic unemployment insurance provided by Congress with the CARES Act early on in the pandemic. And that ends on December 31. They're not getting any money. There's no cash coming in. Some of them will get extended benefits. In some states, there'll be some. It won't be completely, the well won't go completely dry, but it'll go pretty dry. And those folks are going to go into panic mode, right? Because, you know, they're not people that have been able to save any money. They've blown through all their savings. They've probably borrowed every penny they could from friends and family. They've tapped their credit cards. They're done. They have no choice. And, you know, we've got a lot of folks that are, you know, you can see it, food lines, you know, it's obvious. So you got to address that human cost that, and by the way, it's not these, we've got it, obviously it's just these folks, but you know, everyone else is going to be watching this and they're going to be unnerved by it. I mean, you know, it's in a crisis when government has to step up and have the back of all of us. That's why we have, that's the single most important role of government is in times of crisis to have our back. And if the government's not there, then I think people are going to go, everybody is going to go into some form of panic mode, and it's going to be very hard on the economy. And then PPP for small business, because these restaurants aren't going to survive. That's going to, a lot of retailers, gyms, a lot of other recreational transportation, you know, that means if they go out of business, that's going to make it harder for the economy to recover and to get those 10 million people back to work. Help for the airlines. That's strategically important for our long-term economic health. Schools, we've got to get kids, there's going to be long-term costs. You do all those things I just said, and help for state and local government. I forgot. How could I forget?
I was going to remind you of that one.
Yeah. I mean, you know, that's tried and true fiscal support, and it works. It's very, if you don't do it, you're going to see mass layoff, which we've already seen in the state and local governments, that teachers, fire, police, emergency response, people you need at any time, but certainly in a crisis. If you add that all up very quickly, you're at $900 billion.
Easily. That's intended as a bridge through March. Is it important to just do something to get the money out rather than negotiating a big comprehensive bill?
Yeah, in my view, I think speed here is much more important than size. Remember, this is all going away in a few weeks and the pandemic is raging. So sign that $900 billion package. Let's get moving here and let's get to the other side of the inauguration, the Georgia election, see where the political landscape is and see what the economic landscape is, see where we are on the virus and the rollout of the vaccines. And then we collectively come back together and decide what best to do. But at this point, I think it's more about speed than size.
So, Mark, the federal government is issuing massive amounts of debt to pay for these COVID relief packages and just normal operating expenses. The deficit was, top $3 trillion in the fiscal year that just finished. And the debt held by the public is reaching, 100% of GDP if it's not there already. Concord Coalition has taken the position that when this crisis is over, we need a plan to reduce our debt, but there are economists and policy experts that think the United States is special, that because our debt is denominated in U.S. dollars, that we can just print more money to pay it off. When I was a student of economics, my professors taught me that this causes interest rates to rise, the value of the dollar to fall, and inflation to accelerate. But we've not seen any of that yet. Are these so-called new modern monetary theorists or MMTers, are they correct? Do they have the right prescription for our economy, or should we be worrying about debt and deficits?
No, they don't have it right. We should be worried about deficits and debt, just not right now. You know, I do think we need to provide support, deficit finance, fiscal support to get to the other side of the pandemic and give us a nice jump start to get back to full employment. Because if we don't do that, then I think our economy will, as I mentioned earlier, go back into recession, and the cost to the government will be even greater. Our deficits and debt will be even larger. So it's kind of a Hobson's choice. You know, there's no good choice, but the least bad choice from a fiscal perspective is to ante up, you know, get us to the other side, bridge the economy over to the other side, get us going back to full employment as fast as possible. And then as you're approaching full employment, let's say that's 2-3 years from now, then you know, obviously I'm applying a level of precision that may not be possible politically, but if, you know, I'm an economist and I can do this on paper, at least in the model. You pivot and you say, okay, now we need to address our fiscal situation. And that will mean, you know, restraint on spending, and it will mean tax increases both. And you pivot and you do that. If you don't do that, and you continue to deficit spend, and taxes remain low, no change in the tax code, it will just do exactly what your professor told you. The economy will get back to full employment, inflation will accelerate, interest rates will rise, and we will pay a price, you know, significant price in terms of long-term economic growth. I will say one other thing, though. In all likelihood, to generate the political will necessary to address our long-term fiscal problems, let's say when we are approaching full employment, will probably require interest rates to rise. You know, I don't think lawmakers can connect the dots in the minds of the electorate between deficits, debt, and what the economic implications are unless interest rates are rising. I mean, Bob Rubin was able to do that in the 1990s. You could connect the dots. You remember the bond market vigilantes? Clinton said, oh, okay, I get it. And he was very cautious. He gave up on a big fiscal pack, deficit finance fiscal package. And we saw the fruits of that. By the end of that decade, you know, we were back. That's the last time we had a surplus in 2000, was I believe, fiscal year 2000, the last year we had the surplus. But it took higher interest rates in the early 90s, mid-90s, for Bob Rubin, the Secretary of Treasury, to convince everybody, most importantly, President Clinton, that, you know, we need fiscal restraint, and it paid off big. And so, you know, hopefully, you know, we're able to pull off a very similar kind of storyline, you know, down the road when we are back to full employment. But the MMT guys are, you know, they're as wrong as the supply side guys, right? I mean, it's, you have to give them credit. It is an answer to supply side. Supply side, you know, kind of Republicans saw that, you know, I can cut taxes, that'll pay for itself, but don't worry if it doesn't, we'll just cut spending. And the, you know, Democrats really didn't have a response to that until MMT, and MMT as well, we'll increase government spending, it'll pay for itself because of all the activity, economic activity it generates, but don't worry if it doesn't, we'll just raise taxes. So I give them credit, and actually it serves a purpose, right? It kind of offsets the intellectual gendarmerie of the Republicans. So I kind of get it, but the reality is both are wrong, dead wrong.
You wrote a lot about and studied a lot the Great Recession and how the economy fared coming out of it. And you and Tory discussed the typical ramifications of high debt and deficit, you know, higher interest rates, more inflation. But we didn't see that coming out of the Great Recession. Why not try and continue that path? Is it good or bad long term? And why didn't we see those typical responses to a growing deficit at that time?
Well, you may recall it took us a long time to get back to anything considered full employment in that recovery. It was a very painfully slow recovery. In fact, we made a policy error. We pivoted too quickly to try to address our fiscal problems coming out of the financial crisis. That delayed the recovery, and it took us 8 years to get back to what you might consider full employment. So it was a long expansion, much of it characterized by high unemployment, high underemployment, which depressed wage growth and inflation really up until 2018. In 2018, the economy was, we were going to see much higher rates of inflation interest rates. In fact, that was what was exactly what was happening. That was obviously juiced up by the Trump deficit finance, Trump tax cuts. But by the end of 2018, the 10-year treasury yield had risen to 3%, was headed north. Inflation wage growth was accelerating on cue, just as you would expect. But that's when President Trump decided to declare a trade war on everybody, on our allies, on clearly on the Chinese. And you can debate the merits of that, although it's hard to argue that we should be raising tariffs on Canada and Germany and Korea, you know, go figure. But nonetheless, that sucked the wind out of the economy in 2019, you may recall. And the economy felt very fragile coming into 2020. Manufacturing was in recession. The agriculture was in recession. The transportation sector was in recession. In fact, I thought 2020 was going to be a tough year anyway. And it would have probably been a recessionary year, except Trump gave up on the trade war at the very end of 2019, thinking, you know, my view, that, you know, that would hurt his chances to be reelected. So that sucked the wind out of the economy right at the point where the normal business cycle dynamics, the textbook that Tory described earlier, textbook inflation that you'd expect would start to take hold. So I don't think the world has changed. I don't think economics changed. I don't think the way the economy operates has changed. It's just the circumstances, the idiosyncratic circumstances that we face coming out of the financial crisis and President Trump's unorthodox economic policy. And I'm being charitable there.
Related to a lot of what we're talking about here is the importance of interest rates. We've talked about how they're very low now and they stayed low, as Chase mentioned, coming out of the Great Recession. And I think if there's one phenomenon that has dominated the last 10 years or so in the fiscal policy debate, it is what's happening with interest rates. But right now, it seems that we're making a major gamble on interest rates staying, you know, pretty low, not maybe where they are right now, but very, very low by historic rates, which if you play that out, allows the government to take on a heck of a lot more debt than we would have thought was prudent at any time before that. I wanted to get your take on why interest rates have been so unusually low and what might change to make them go higher. But when we think about a post-pandemic economic growth policy, what might go wrong for that low interest rate scenario?
I think it's fair to say that interest rates and inflation were surprisingly low in the recovery, the 10-year long recovery and expansion coming out of the financial crisis. The biggest surprise to me as a macroeconomist in that expansion was how low inflation interest rates remained. There's a number of factors, but I'll mention three very quickly. First, I do think it took us a long time to get back to full employment. I mean, it was a very slow recovery. I mean, painfully slow, and partly because of the fiscal restraint that was inappropriately applied too early coming out of that period. And of course, it was also the result of the financial crisis, the fact that the financial system caved, required a government bailout, and it took a long time for the financial system to get back up and running, repair itself, and start providing credit in a fulsome way. And so that hurt the economic recovery. So reason number one, we didn't get back to full employment. Reason number two, there was a global saving. I mean, the bond markets became much more globally oriented since the 1990s. In the 90s, it was primarily domestically focused, but by, you know, the 2010s, it was very globally oriented. So it was not only what was going on here in the United States, it's, you know, what's going on everywhere else in the world. And because Europe was flat on its back and Japan flat on its back, you know, negative interest rates that, you know, put downward pressure onto long-term interest rates. And third, I do think technology and globalization came together and, you know, created competitive forces that depressed inflation. You know, businesses didn't have pricing power. They lost their competitive edge because they had to compete as technologies, upset their business models, and they had to compete against the Chinese that were coming on and so forth. And of course, China's entry also played a role in all of this. So I think it's a melange of things that surprise. I'll say this, though, going forward, I think the biggest surprise will be, from a macroeconomic perspective, how high inflation interest rates will be going forward. And the reason is that I do think the recovery here is going to be a lot faster than after the financial crisis. This economy is, I think it's going to be 3 years to get back to full employment, not 8 years to get back to full employment. And we can talk about why, but, you know, some obvious reasons. The financial system has remained, you know, because of Fed actions, insulated from the chaos in the economy, no problem in the financial system. The reforms after the financial crisis put the financial system on very solid ground. But more importantly, I think the Fed wants higher inflation. I mean, I think it was ambivalent about higher inflation in the 2010s. Like, yeah, I'd like higher inflation, but 2% is my cap. And, you know, let's debate it. Now there's no debate. The monetary policy framework has changed. We are going to see above target inflation. The Fed is going to keep the foot flat on the accelerator up in as we're coming into full employment. Inflation's above target. That's a difficult thing to navigate, you know, get there and then bring the plane right on the tarmac, 2% inflation, life is good. That's going to be pretty hard to do. The second thing is debt loads are much, much higher. Governments are borrowing hand over fist everywhere on the planet. And that's not going to change anytime soon. And actually, there's a lot of corporate debt too, and household debt here, but in the rest of the world. So leverage is rising pretty rapidly. In fact, one of the downsides of navigating through this pandemic the way we have is we have not addressed any of the underlying fundamental structural problems in the economy that typically get fixed in a recession, you know, the creative destruction part of recession. That's not happening here. Leverage is actually higher coming out of this thing, not lower. So I do think Concord Coalition is going to be much more relevant in the coming decade than you've always been relevant, but more relevant in the coming decade than in the past decade, because interest rates are going to be higher and you're going to be able to connect those dots for people. You can say, look, this is what's going on and it's going to cost us if we don't address it.
This is Facing the Future. You've been listening to Dr. Mark Zandi, Chief Economist from Moody's Analytics, Concord's Policy Director, Tory Gorman, and Executive Director, Bob Bixby, discuss economic trends and fiscal and monetary policy, as well as what should be considered for the next COVID-19 relief package. Thank you for joining the show, Mark, Bob, and Tory.
Thanks so much. It was a pleasure. Thanks, everyone. Thank you.
Up next, I'll be joined by Concord's National Field Director, Phil Smith, and Congressman Kwanzaa Hall from Georgia to discuss his unique role and position as he serves out the remaining term of the late Congressman John Lewis. We'll be back after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman, and I'm joined on the show by Congressman Kwanzaa Hall and Phil Smith. Phil is the Concord Coalition's National Field Director. Congressman Hall is currently serving in Georgia's 5th District, completing the late Congressman John Lewis's term. Prior to serving in Congress, he served for 15 years as an elected official on Atlanta City Council and on the Atlanta School Board. Prior to that, he served on the Atlanta Board of Education, is the immediate past chair of the Atlanta City Council's International Relations Committee, served on the World Affairs Council, Leadership Atlanta, and the National Center for Civil and Human Rights. And we're really happy to have him on the show. Welcome to Facing the Future, Phil and Congressman Hall.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chase.
We have the congressman for a very brief amount of time, so we'll dive right in. And right out the gate, Congressman, I'm incredibly curious. What's it like to, one, be a member of Congress, but also to be stepping into the shoes of such a legend and hero as Congressman Lewis?
Well, you know, first and foremost, I'm very humbled and feel truly privileged to have earned this moment in history. I'm the immediate successor to Congressman Lewis. He was a friend of my family. He worked in civil rights with my father. My father was in Montgomery and Selma at the same time that Congressman Lewis was brutally beaten on the Edmund Pettus Bridge. And like I said, he was just a few houses down from us. And through high school and college, he and his late wife, Lillian, mentored me and they supported me. And we worked together when I was a city councilman and he was a congressman. So it's a little surreal, but to whom much is given, much is required. So oftentimes you don't know what you're being prepared for. And you have to step right into those shoes and keep it moving. I'm not trying to fill his shoes. I'm just wearing mine, but trying to do the work and pick up the baton and pass it on to the next generation.
That's great. And I think I skipped a step. I also wanted to ask, what was it like to campaign for Congress in such a historic district?
Well, you know, I've represented City Hall as a city councilman and a school board member for 2 years on school board and 13 on city council. So my district was the most geographically and socioeconomically diverse. So that was natural for me to kind of talk to all types of people, but it was much larger. My district was only 40,000 people and the congressional district is 700,000 plus, and it's much wider, 9 square miles roughly, or 9 mile radius. So it was a lot more energy, a lot more time. And we were after 3 other elections already. So the electorate was very tired. And then we were in between. So first we were between the June race and the runoff, as well as the November 3rd. And then we had a runoff in December. So this, and then we have another runoff in January 5th. So people, voter confusion, voter suppression, you know, just a lot of craziness around what's going on in Georgia has been the conversation in the state and in the nation, or actually in the world. Everybody wants to know what's going to happen with these Senate seats. So that was really, are you running against Warnock? You run against Purdue? I mean, so people just, you know, it lets you know how little voters know. Are you running against Nikema Williams? So people really didn't know what the race was about until they discovered that there's a need to finish the term. Mm-hmm. And I've enjoyed trying to explain it to my friends who, even some of the most accomplished political leaders, did not know what was happening. So, you know, it's been a good moment and I'm thankful again to be here.
And I know Congressman Phil has some questions of his own, but I do have one more before I pass it off to him for a few minutes. You know, you mentioned that you're walking in your own shoes and you're in a really unique circumstance for how short of a period you're going to be on Capitol Hill, at least right now. Who knows what the future has in store? But what are you trying to accomplish right now? What are some of your goals?
So there are very significant measures in front of our country. Usually this is the lame duck period. But this is probably the most consequential period we've seen in probably 100 years. We've never seen, first, with the exception of World War II, our debt this high. And then number two, we have already passed several billion dollars in stimulus relief in the first CARES Act. And now we've got yet another one coming in front of us of potentially another $1 billion, 900 or 8, or we don't know what it's going to turn out to be. We've got the military spending bill that's in front of us. And then we have just the continuing resolution. We had cannabis. I voted on that basically a day, less than 24 hours from when I arrived and was sworn in by Speaker Nancy Pelosi. I got to take that vote on the MORE Act, which was obviously introduced and by Senator Kamala Harris, our vice president elect. So this is, there's a lot of history in this, but I'm moving so fast. You know, usually onboarding for freshmen, congressmen and women is probably 2 months. I've done it in 2 hours. So I got all my paperwork, my badge and my seal and everything else in 2 hours flat. And I had to get out there and get sworn in and do my whole, you know, so it was fast as a whirlwind, but I'm enjoying it. And I'll look back at it and say, oh yeah, that did happen. But it's about the people right now. The COVID relief is the biggest thing that we've got to get a deal on. I know I heard recently that they were removing the stimulus checks and only saying, you know, business relief and business support. But, you know, if you're a millionaire, you're a billionaire, you're making these decisions, it's easy to just say, oh, people can wait. But waiting any longer really causes people to be potentially evicted. It causes people to, I mean, companies to shut down, businesses to close, and more jobs to be lost. There's a lot at stake right now, and families are hurting. They're feeling the pain. And it was, you know, initially it was a true stress for those who had kids in school, but you're feeling, they figured it out, but still there's a true exposure of the digital divide. We have disruption in education. I think we should take advantage of that. We haven't really taken advantage of this moment to see that those who are living most of the margins are not receiving the adequate level of Wi-Fi access to even access to power. Some homes don't have power. So how can your kids go to school? And some don't have the ability to have live-in tutors and nannies, or even just, you know, neighborhood support networks that can help parents who have 2 and 3 jobs to, you know, make it an easier environment for their kids to learn. And if you don't give kids a way up and change the trajectory, you end up going through the education and the school, the prison pipeline. So I think there's a lot of things in front of us that we could actually correct in light of the fact that we've been kind of throwing lemons. I like the idea of taking lemons and turning them into lemonade. You know, I'm proposing that District 5 be a COVID innovation zone. We look at the CDC being in District 5 and the world's busiest airport with on average every year, at least 110 million passengers. It's less than that now significantly, but still far more passengers than any other place in the world. And because Atlanta has, you know, done a close and open based on state and city conflict, it's still kind of moving in a very robust way. And what we're seeing is people coming from all over the country who are transient and bringing coronavirus, or they're becoming resilient to coronavirus. This is interesting thing happening there. And what I'm proposing is that we look at it as a potential place, and maybe we do it in honor of Congressman Lewis, make it a COVID innovation zone. We look at what are the jobs of the future, jobs around testing, jobs around the contact tracing, jobs around the PPE that needs to be created, jobs around the plexiglass screens that divide us so we can talk to each other. I mean, there's all this new stuff. It doesn't have to be made outside of the United States. It could reinvigorate manufacturing. So I just think we've got to look at this carefully and think about the pivots that need to happen. Those who figured out the pivot and they're ready and nimble and they're kind of agile, they've actually been able to do very well. And then there's others who've kind of held on to the old ways and they're very rigid. They're failing and they're dying, and some have already bit the dust.
Congressman, I have a question about bipartisanship.
Yes.
I was so impressed when the Speaker of the House swore you in. You were then introduced to your colleagues by Democratic Congressman Sanford Bishop and also Republican Congressman Rob Woodall, both of Georgia. And they both said very nice things about you. And we've come to realize that not one party is big enough to conquer all the big challenges, particularly ones that we look at the Concord Coalition. So I'm interested, how have you been able to succeed? Because I've watched you firsthand here in Georgia be bipartisan. When people wanted you to be hyperpartisan, you've been willing to reach out to the other side. What's your history with that? And what's your secret to your success? How can we encourage more of that?
Well, thank you, Phil. You know, and first and foremost, I was raised by parents who made sure that you focus on meeting the individual before you decide how you're going to feel about them. That's very important. You can't make another person an enemy before you've even had a chance to engage. As a school board member and a council member, both positions were nonpartisan. So for sure in education, we do not need partisan any more conflict and challenge than we have already with just trying to educate our kids. In the city council, the same thing was true. I grew up a Democrat, but my district included the Central Business District and a very, very strong anti-war, very progressive liberal and neoliberal community to the Far East, Emmett Park and Ponce Highlands and Grant Park and Ormwood Park. So I had the benefit of both groups. And then I had very low income African-American community in the Bedford Pines Boulevard corridor. So all three of these forced me to figure a strategy on how to create a shared vision around things that everybody wants, as opposed to thinking about just the special interest groups, the groups with the most money or the groups with the loudest voice. But what are the things, the four or five things we all can agree upon, and never start off assuming anyone is your enemy, even if you've heard bad things about them. Still engage head on. And I'll tell you, one of the most interesting things that's happened, I was in the hallway outside of the floor to the Congress, and AOC walked up and I got a chance to speak to her and say hello, and you know, just good to meet you. And, you know, just told her to keep fighting her good fight. I understand she's fighting for what she believes in. Literally 1 minute later, I got a group text from a gentleman who was introducing me to Ted Yoho. So, you know, I couldn't have planned that. It was divine. And then I went in the well and I met Ted and had a chance to chat with him. We have a mutual friend. So, you know, I think if you're open and you're willing and available at least to begin to bridge the gap. So I consider myself now, I've got to figure out how to get to know both of them and see if I can, you know, mend the fences for them one day. You know, a person like me is just, you know, open to trying to be a bridge between people, but still people have to treat one another right. And you've got to be willing to stand up. And if you see injustice anywhere, you know, and in the words of Martin Luther King, injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. So when I see things, I call them out. But I also try to be available to listen to people, because until you hear them, you can't build the level of trust and rapport to even call them on a bad thing, because you don't know them well enough. And when you check someone before you know them, they're easily offended, and then they just kind of bottle up and go into the corner, and you're an enemy as well. So I try to be a bridge builder. meet everyone where they are and bring them to a new accord and a new place of peace and reconciliation.
Well, Congressman, I want to be sensitive to your time. I have dozens of questions I could just keep rattling off. It's such a pleasure to talk to you. And we'll end this segment there. That's a great positive note to end our conversation on. This is Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. You've been listening to me, Phil Smith, and Congressman Kwanzaa Hall. We discussed his unique position serving in the remaining term of the late Congressman John Lewis, key votes in legislation, even a little fiscal policy. Thanks for joining the show, Phil and Congressman Hall.
Thank you, Chase. Great to see you,
Phil. Thank you, Chase. Thank you, Congressman.
You've been Facing the Future. I'm Chase Hageman. Thanks for listening.